This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with Greg Merriweather, anchor for WAFB, the top-rated television news station in this area. Greg Merriweather came to this area 17 years ago. He was the street beat reporter for many years, and we'll talk with him about those 17 years and what's going on in our community right now. Also, Dan Moldea, the intrepid investigative reporter on the 25th anniversary of the death of Vince Foster, aide to President Bill Clinton, former law partner to Hillary Clinton. Much mystery surrounded his death, and Dan Moldea has some thoughts about what happened at Fort Marcy Park on this date in 1993. And Molly Buckman of the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater on some acclaimed instructors coming to join forces with her group. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. In Baton Rouge, the local dial is 297-5633. You can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill producing, and in studio is Greg Merriweather, the anchor for WAFB, who's been in this community for 17 years now, a guy who came here right out of college. From Kentucky, right?
And had a full head of hair then. Don't have it anymore, but yes.
Well, you're out chasing all those criminals, I remember.
Well.
You were the street beat guy, and next to George and Donna, you were the best-known person on the station, I'm sure. People everywhere. In fact, they called you street beat, didn't they?
They do. And still do. Yeah, in fact, I just got it yesterday, actually. So, yeah, I was out at a cancer services thing for these kids, and several of the ladies there were like, I go back with you all the way to street beat. So that's my go-to line as well. Then I had a full head of hair back then. So, yeah. It put me on the map for sure because it was a rare time in Louisiana. We had the serial killer case starting, as we were chatting about just a few moments ago. And a lot of folks were watching television and scared. And, you know, that was before Twitter and Facebook and all those good things. So you had to get your news no matter what from us. We didn't have an app then. We barely had a website. So you had to tune into the 10 o'clock news to see what was going on. And if you had a kid at LSU while the serial killers weren't around, you were pretty much worried about that.
I remember vividly Pat Inglade having those daily press conferences with the Baton Rouge banner behind him. Talk about an advertisement for the city,
right?
Talking about a serial killer out there wreaking havoc. And this was serious stuff. And I think the first one that we really knew about was Gina Wilson Green, that was definitively linked to a, quote, serial killer. And that was September of 01, must have been right after you got here.
Yeah, it literally was. And then 2 weeks after that, Charlotte Mary Pace was killed. And we didn't realize then that, but that's when we first started thinking, this is a little odd, it's a little unusual. And then it was the Advocate, actually, that Melissa Moore did that terrific spread where it showed all the women that were missing in Baton Rouge over the last few years and just got people really thinking what was going on with that serial killer case. And then we turned out we had several actually operating at the same time.
Yeah, but the most notorious was Derek Todd Lee. And for a long time, they were looking for a white guy in a white truck.
We even had a guy stop by the station, and he was a white guy in a white truck, and he had written on the back of the truck, yes, I'm a white guy, yes, this is a white truck, but no, I'm not the serial killer, because people were that in tuned to what was going on and calling him in.
Mm-hmm. And about 1,000 people, including some of my good friends, were swabbed as potential suspects.
Here's the secret. We had an engineer at the station that was swabbed twice. They didn't take the he fit so much of the profile at one point that his neighbor turned him in, and then they had to swab him, and they swabbed him twice.
Really? First time wasn't good enough.
Wasn't good enough. They didn't trust it.
Well, it was a perilous time in our community. And as you know, when things are going bad, those are quite often the, quote, best news days.
Yeah, it's always been a weird thing. We try not to look at it as, you know, good for business or something, you know, along those lines. But it does elevate at least people watching, and it elevates your presence in the community and your relevance, basically. So, and as I said, that was also before digital media. And if you really wanted to know what was going on, or you wanted to know what Pat Inglade said in that daily press conference, you either watched it live on our cable channel or you tuned in for the 6 o'clock news.
Greg Merriweather is with us, top anchor man for WAFB and I think you're 39 years old, right?
Yes.
So he's got a lot of years to go. It is amazing, Greg, if he lasts as long as George Sells, you'll be working here another 30 or 40 years. So
yeah, that's what was ironic is there, and George is going to hate me for this, but there's 20 years between George and Donna, and there was 20 years between me and Donna. So Donna was the one that brought that up to me. So when I first started anchoring with her, she said, I'm used to somebody, you know, 20 years older than me, and I've got to get used to somebody 20 years younger than me. So it was pretty good, though. I don't think we missed a beat. So
no, and you were there at the end, and you were there for the last year, which, of course, was very challenging for Donna, but she soldiered on. But it had to be difficult to see this great talent being diminished by ALS.
Yeah, because, I mean, it came on so fast, and she had some really good days or good weeks, and then she'd have really bad days and bad weeks. Fell in the newsroom a couple times, which I think she shared with several of the people. And, you know, it started out, she had surgery on her leg, and she was on a scooter, and even at that time I was taking her home at night after the newscast because she lives kind of on my way, and she wasn't driving at the time, and she never really got back into driving after that. It just kind of slowly started, kind of quickly, sometimes spiraling into this.
Well, she's a brave person, and I'm sure she will continue to be that way. I saw her Sunday. She's amazing. She sat through a church service that lasted about 3 hours and then went to lunch after that with the congregation. So
yeah,
she's an amazing, as is her husband, Mark Ballard, who is frequently with us. But 2 years ago this week, a big moment in your career, a tragic time for our community, the death of the three officers. You got the call, and you
yes.
were there.
Yeah, so I was at home, literally just woken up, and my phone rang, and it was my news director, who's also a good personal friend of mine, and I just answered the phone very casually, just like, hello. And he was very stern on the other end. It was like, we've got some officers down. We're going on the air shortly. I'm going to need you to come in. And the last thing he said was, bring a tie. I just remembered that, and so I grabbed one. And I saw that tie the other day. I retired it. I put it in my closet. I wasn't going to wear it anymore after that. But I just got to the station, and at that point, I'd called a few of our sources. And we knew, at least I knew when I went on the air, that we at least had two officers dead. I knew that from one source. And we'd like to, you know, especially on something so delicate as that, we'd like to make sure we've got that confirmed and double confirmed. So I just kind of held that in my back pocket, but I knew when I was going on the air, we were breaking into Sunday morning programming, that was going to be a jolt to Baton Rouge. So the best thing I could think of was sort of like when somebody calls you and says, hey, are you sitting down, you know, and they have to deliver some horrible news. That's when we broke in. That was in the back of my mind was, hey, Baton Rouge, sit down. We've got some really bad news to tell you. We've got, and at that point we didn't know where the suspects were or suspect. And, you know, it was a very, very scary time for all of us, and to go on the air and know that you have two officers dead, it was, and trying to keep that in the back of your head, it was a little tough.
And that month was a horrible month, and the flood came in August, but in July, not only this, the death of the three officers, but what preceded that was Alton Sterling being killed, and Alton Sterling's death certainly caused a lot of division, and you saw it firsthand. I recall people trying to get into the station, protesters who were upset about what had happened.
Yeah, if you think about that July, and I was looking back at my calendar recently, I mean, all of this happened in a matter of about 3 weeks. Alton Sterling was killed early mornings, late July 4th, early morning, July 5th. And then a few days later, the Dallas officers were killed. Mm-hmm. And then you had Castile, I believe was his name, who was shot, and his girlfriend Facebook lived it. So all that happened, and then people were protesting, and then there was that Sunday that folks basically surrounded the station, and we were looking at some old video from that, and you can see Montrell Jackson. He stands out. He was one of the officers out there protecting the station that day, and who would have ever dreamed that within a matter of days he would lose his life?
Mm-hmm. Well, a few days ago right here, Governor John Bel Edwards is doing his radio show, and I read recently in the New York Times that Governor Jerry Brown on most days has no security. He's governor of California, which, of course, is a state with about one-eighth of the American population, but John Bel Edwards does have security, and he was fortunate to have it the other day as he sat right in your chair before he got here out in the lobby. Allie, let's give a listen to what happened when the governor arrived just a couple of days ago to do his monthly radio show.
We want St. James to have an evacuation route. We want St. James to have an evacuation route. We want St. James to have an evacuation route. We want St. James to have an evacuation route. We want St. James to have an evacuation route.
Disabled.
These are disabled people that don't have a voice, who can't get out, and that's why we're here. They can barely get out of their homes, let alone if there's an event.
All right, The governor's always polite, as he was then, but one of our producers, J.C. Kane, said that one of these ladies actually pushed him.
Really?
You know, even though he has security,
sure,
and pushed the governor, and he did not respond, as he would not expect. He is an elegant man in every way, but
sure,
but something like that is potentially dangerous.
It is, and it really, I think, it kind of realized that we all have a false sense of security. You got a lot of people out there that sometimes have a lot of axes to grind, and you know, if they can't get it out on Twitter, they can't get it out on Facebook in a rant, sometimes they'll find you and wherever you are.
877-217-5757. Greg Merriweather is with us. He became well known in Baton Rouge as the street beat reporter, and now is in the prime position anchoring the 6 and 10 News on WAFB, and he is a man who knows our community pretty well, having covered the news almost every day for 17 years. If you'd like to send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. You're listening to Talk Louisiana on WRKF. We'll be back after this brief pause for more with Greg. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Greg Merriweather is with us, the anchor for the 6 and 10 News on WAFB. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. talk@talklouisiana.org is our email address. And I have a few emails that hopefully we'll be able to get to before we part company with Greg. But he's with us for one more segment. Now, Greg Merriweather is a native of Louisville,
Kentucky.
Louisville.
Yes, sir. Lowell, yeah.
Louisville.
Yeah, you have to kind of mumble it to get it to say it right.
Well, for those who have not been there, it's a great city, isn't it?
It is. It's Derby City, so if you ever get a chance to go to Kentucky Derby, if that's on your bucket list at all, definitely mark it off because it's terrific. Mm-hmm. It's like a mini Chicago. It's kind of undiscovered.
Right on the Ohio River, lots of green trees. It's a beautiful city.
It really is. It was a pleasure growing up there.
But you came this way, and now this is home.
It is. I've been here now, married, and it's become a good little place to live.
Well, it's an interesting news place. As I've stated, we have in Louisiana 1.4% of the national population. We generate far more than 1.4% of the national news.
It, and sometimes, very unfortunately, we were talking about serial killers, but then it was for a while we were going through that whole stretch where there was always a Baton Rouge connection to every story. The snipers that were taking over D.C., you know, happened to be practicing in Scotlandville. I mean, who would have ever thought that? And, just all the different stories back to back to back. I mean, used to we counted our lives around Katrina. Now we count our lives around the 2016 floods. So it's one of those deals.
Okay, we're going to get to a few of the emails, and once again, if you'd like to call, 877-217-5757 or 297-5633. Gustavo says, hats off to this young man for his amazing climb to the anchor chair, a true testament to perseverance, tenacity, and clean ambition. God bless and much success. Those are the kinds of emails you can handle, right?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Gustavo. That was terrific.
Here's one from Sabrina, and a good one, noting that your colleague, Matt Williams was on this show and said he didn't like consultants. Do you like consultants, Greg Merriweather?
They're okay. Sometimes we were talking about how unique Louisiana is, and sometimes you can't have a one-size-fits-all approach, and sometimes that's what consultants do.
877-217-5757. Louise from Highland Road. Louise, you're on the air with Greg.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I've been watching WAFB for a long time, and Greg is really outstanding. His coverage is so apolitical in the sense that he delivers the news, in my opinion, as it should be reported, very unbiased. And it's a pleasure being able to watch him during the shooting that you were just discussing. I was just amazed at his composure and the way he was able to deliver the news with all the mitigating factors surrounding him. And just he's a great reporter, and WAFB is certainly fortunate to have him.
Well, thank you, Louise. I appreciate it. You made my Friday there. My mom's middle name is Louise, but I promise this is not my mom calling. I certainly appreciate it. It's one of the best compliments I think a journalist can get is that I've had people tell me that they don't know if I'm a Republican or a Democrat. And so that to me is at least a good thing because I was thinking about tonight. I don't watch the national news anymore.
You don't?
I don't. I used to be – I have Sirius XM in my car, and I have Fox News and CNN and all those news channels. I used to listen to them all the time, and I can't do it anymore. It's the national media is fighting Trump, and Trump is fighting the national media, and it's just – it just gets to be too much noise. And so I have to tune out something, and that's what I picked to tune out. I obviously keep up with what's going on and know those things, but mm-hmm. as far as sitting there watching it 24 hours or to kill time, I just can't do it anymore.
A few years ago when we had the mayor's election, Greg was the moderator for a debate. I was on the panel, but one of those things that you didn't expect is you're moderating the debate with Sharon Weston Broome and Bodie White. A bug right
yes.
in the middle of the debate flies right into Bodie White's eyes. The man's trying to speak.
Talk about
bad luck.
Y'all got bugs. That's what he said right after, live on the air. But I was sitting there, and I looked over. I mean, I was as close as I am to you right now to him, and I saw it crawling on his face. It was an ant. And I thought then, I was like, do I just make a moment and reach over and grab it off or swat it? What do I do? And I didn't do anything, and sure enough, it went into his eye. And so I don't know if that was the bug that cost him the election. But
last night, a lively Metro Council meeting. Denise yes, Amoroso sir. Was appointed to fill her late husband's seat. But getting to that point was an inexact process.
You know, I don't know anyone who's ever said anything bad about Councilman Amoroso. He was always so accessible to us, and it didn't matter the issue or if he was on the right side or wrong side of it. In his mind, he always did an interview with us, and I often thought last night what he might be thinking at that whole process, because he was one of the more moderate members of the Metro Council, and to see them so divided over his seat, I don't want to use the horrible cliche, turning over in his grave, but I can't say that he was probably happy with what was going on last night.
Well, we do live, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, we do live in a city that has some division, and it's reflected on the Metro Council.
I think it was brought up several times. There's a big dividing line. It's either Florida Boulevard or Government Street, depending on how you look mm-hmm. at it. It's the North Baton Rouge, South Baton Rouge. And you know, growing up in Louisville, we had 25 different neighborhoods. Here I can name maybe five, but you can basically, unfortunately, narrow them all down to either North Baton Rouge or South Baton Rouge.
Well, Greg Merriweather came from Louisville, kind of like a guy who became the most famous man on the planet, Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, how about that?
Did you ever run into him?
I thought you were going to say Rudy Macklin.
Well, Rudy was pretty
favorite strong. Yes.
But Rudy said when he was a kid that Muhammad kind of embraced him. He knew everybody who was anybody in Louisville, and he tried to help him.
Muhammad Ali came and spoke to one of my schools, and I'm sure the story has been told before, but he levitated. He did a little magic trick in front of all the students, and I finally figured out how he did it, but for many, many years, I couldn't figure out exactly how he lifted himself off the ground. But he certainly did it right there in front of all of us.
Jeez, did he walk on water?
It was very close to that, but if you can imagine him sitting there and he was shaking, and, you know, it was a whole lot of theatrics, and all of a sudden, there's his legs go right off the ground.
And the Alley Center in downtown Louisville is quite a place if you ever go there. That's a place that is a must-see.
They even have his original bike there that got stolen. And that got him so angry that the cop said, hey, you need to put that anger into perhaps something more constructive.
It made him a boxer. When you came to Baton Rouge, what did you know about Louisiana?
You know, to be honest with you, I knew it was the capital, only because we know the state capitals. Mm-hmm. I was up for a job. I was coming straight out of college, so I was up for a job in Lexington, Kentucky, which would have been really close to home. The Quad Cities, which is Moline, Iowa, and Davenport, and that way up in Iowa, and here in Huntsville. But it ended up coming between here and there. So Baton Rouge is Market 95, and Quad Cities is like 96. So I remember thinking I could be an hour away from New Orleans, or basically, and the only thing the city had there was the headquarters of John Deere. So it was kind of an easy decision to make. And I look back on it, though, I don't know how I really did it, though, because I'm an only child. I'm very close to my mom and my dad, and they're both still living together. But I just took a leap of faith and came down. I only knew one person in Louisiana. It was the person giving me the job.
And that was?
Vicki Zimmerman. She just retired.
Quite a person.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she's talked about somebody who loved the news, too.
She loved it and lived it and still does.
And that's something when you're doing this, as you do, if you don't like the news, you're going to have real problems. She liked the news, and I know you like it as well. And the two people who were well-known at Channel 9 for many years, George and Donna, they
sure
loved following what was going on in the world.
Well, and we used to rate them from you, though. We got Julie Baxter and Shauna Sanford and just some terrific...
A lot of people who I worked with.
Yeah, some terrific talent, and they all gave you credit for giving them their start in the business. And so that was back when I think we have a terrific set of reporters now. We really had a powerful set of reporters back then, moving and grooving.
Well, we're glad you're anchoring the news, as he will tonight. Greg Merriweather, thanks for joining us. Let's do it again soon.
Yes, sir.
We'll be back with Dan Moldea after this pause for Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Dan Moldea is our guest, one of the top investigative journalists of all time, and he has reported on many aspects of our world, and usually it involves some kind of controversy. And in the last 25 years, there's probably been no bigger controversy than the suicide of Vince Foster. Dan Moldea wrote a book about it in 1998, 5 years after the death of Vince Foster, A Washington Tragedy, How the Suicide of Vince Foster Ignited a Political Firestorm. And Dan, it is always a pleasure to share the microphone with you.
Jim, always a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Well, it is believed definitively to be a suicide, and yet I still hear people say that Vince Foster was murdered. How do you answer those people who are skeptics?
It's interesting. I was I had done a book about the O.J. Simpson case with Tom Lang and Phil Van Atta, the two lead detectives of the case, and Al Regnery, who's the owner of Regnery Publishing, had published a book by Mark Furman, the racist Fifth Amendment taking, perjuring, convicted ex-LAPD guy. And there was a controversy in that, in a standards publishing contract, the author gives first right of refusal for his next book to the publisher that published his previous book. And Furman had promised to give that book to Regnery. He wanted to do a book about the murder of Vincent Foster. And so they rejected that theory, and they came to me, and they offered me $100,000 for basically a six-month investigation to do a book about Vince Foster. Now, Regnery, as everyone knows, is a very conservative publisher. And I said, why me? You know, I'm a liberal guy. I didn't have any particular angle on the campaign or anything. I voted for Bill Clinton in 92 and 96, and but I think that the Regnery people wanted me to come up with some sort of information indicating that there was something nefarious that had happened there. They had a book come out by a guy named Ambrose Evans Pritchard, which basically laid out a murder scenario. And instead, I came in with a book at the end of 1997. Saying that it was basically a right-wing conspiracy to make it look like a murder and to make it look like the Clintons had been either directly involved in the murder or certainly involved in the cover-up of the circumstances of that alleged murder. Mm-hmm. And basically, the suicide of Vince Foster really led to a firestorm in that there was a demand, because there was an erroneous article in the New York Times about the discovery of Whitewater documents, and this led to the forcing of Janet Reno, then the Attorney General, to appoint a special counsel from the Justice Department, like Robert Mueller, named Bob Fisk, who was a very respected Republican prosecutor who was former head of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York. And he ran an investigation concluding that Vince Foster had committed suicide. And then that began the firing of Fisk because of pressure by the Republicans in Congress who wanted something more nefarious to happen. And so that led to the reapplication of the independent counsel law, which would be where the independent counsel would be appointed by three appellate judges, and they appointed Ken Starr. And that begat the investigations, which led to the Monica Lewinsky case, which, of course, led to the impeachment and acquittal of Bill Clinton. But it all started with the Vincent Foster suicide, yeah, which happened 25 years ago today, as you point out.
Exactly 6 months after President Clinton took office.
To the day, right.
July 20th, 1993. And he and Foster went back to their youth in Hope, Arkansas. They knew each other for almost their entire lives. They were good friends. Vincent Foster was a law partner of Hillary Clinton.
Correct.
There were rumors, and I say rumors, never confirmed, that there might have been a romantic entanglement between Hillary and Vince Foster. But when he died, there were all kinds of rumors, and some of them were actually uttered in places like this. On May 20th of 1994, Rush Limbaugh, on his show, went so far as to say that he had evidence that Vince Foster was murdered in an apartment owned by Hillary Clinton and dragged to Fort Marcy Park.
In a blanket. They had wrapped him in a rug. They had wrapped him in a rug and then dragged him to Fort Marcy Park because there were particles of a rug found on his body during the subsequent crime scene search, which was conducted by the park police. What I did, Jim, was my book is really about the investigations of, is my analysis of the investigations of Foster's death, his suicide. And what I had discovered was that just like these other situations where you have, when you don't have full disclosure on these big, high-profile deaths, it's going to result in conspiracy theories. And in this particular case, you had one particular official in the park police who was giving out erroneous information, which led to most of the conspiracy theories, including those which were perpetrated by the New York Times. And you know, and I pick on the New York Times on this because of their great influence on these events on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I can't say enough about the New York Times for all they're doing right now, the tremendous work, the investigative journalism that's going on at the Times right now with regard to our current situation here in Washington. But you know, back then they were writing some horrible things, which led to a whole bunch of controversies which were picked up by the lesser media and certainly the right-wing media, which ran with it. And again, in a cynical effort to try to cast doubt and blame on the Clintons. And when Hillary Clinton talked about the right-wing conspiracy against she and her husband back after the Monica Lewinsky broke, and my book came out right after the Monica Lewinsky case was exploded onto the headlines. I think I was the first book that came out that mentioned Monica Lewinsky between the covers of a book. And what she was referring to, all the fallout that came as a result of the suicide of her close friend, and as you point out, her former law partner, Vince Foster.
All right. A few questions. One online, and I've actually found the so-called note that Vince Foster wrote, torn into 27 pieces in a briefcase, but It starts, I made mistakes from ignorance, inexperience, and overwork, and it closes, I was not meant for the job or the spotlight of public life in Washington. Here, ruining people is considered sport. Was he a terribly troubled man at the time of his death?
Frankly, I think that there were editorials that were being written about him by the Wall Street Journal, I guess, playing off on the erroneous Times material about Whitewater and the Whitewater documents. But the investigations, these so-called investigations of Foster were really nothing compared to other kinds of investigations here in Washington. And I think that my analysis of the situation, I came to the conclusion that I think Foster's motive for his suicide, in which he acted alone, came more from his personal life than from from what he was doing professionally here in Washington.
He was 48 years old, a spectacularly handsome man, very tall, much taller than Bill Clinton, who's a tall man. And he towered over people throughout his life, seemed to have a wonderful life, a beautiful wife. What was going on?
On the day he left his home, let me just, I note the fact that his wife got remarried 6 months after his death. She married a judge down in Arkansas. I don't mean that to cast aspersions or anything, but I think that he was upset in his marriage, and he remembered his wife. I think remembered him looking at her very coldly when he left that morning. Again, I think that I don't want to speculate here. With I stand by what's in my book about the motive being more in his personal life than in his professional life.
You went to Fort Marcy Park, didn't you?
Oh yeah. Many times, yeah. I went there with Regnery, and that was the other thing. A lot of the conspiracy theories that came along had basically gotten the wrong location. For instance, Chris Reddy, who is the big buddy of President Trump right now, in his initial work about this case, which was financed by Richard Scaife during their right-wing conspiracy against the Clintons, which is provable. He got Vince Foster in the wrong spot. He had him in the wrong spot, and he was basing all kinds of conclusions about Foster's death as a result of his erroneous information that he was providing his readers. And then the conspiracy crowd came in and covered up for him as a result of, the symbiotic relationship among all of these conspiracy people who were trying to lay blame for Foster's death at the feet of the Clintons.
Vince Foster is buried in Hope, Arkansas. Vincent Walker Foster, Jr., January 15, 1945, July 20, 1995. As mentioned, the man was only 48 years old. He was eulogized at St. Andrew's Cathedral in Little Rock by Bill Clinton. And Clinton, for all that could be seen, was terribly affected by this. They were close friends and colleagues.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think Vince Foster, when Bill Clinton was elected president, I think he wanted a big job in Washington. And I think that the Clintons viewed him as, and he was a hotshot attorney with the Rose Law Firm down in Little Rock. I mean, he was a big man in a little town. And he found himself sort of submerged in Washington where he...
Okay, we do have to take a break, but we will return with Dan Moldea after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF. And coming in just a bit, Molly Bookman, the veteran dance master and mistress for the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater, with some big news about her great group. But we're wrapping it up with the intrepid investigative reporter, Dan Moldea, who for many years has covered the major stories of the day. And in 1998, he wrote a book about the suicide of Vince Foster. Vince Foster took his life 25 years ago today. He was a colleague, a boyhood friend of President Clinton, and he killed himself on the 20th day of July, 1993. And I'm trying to get our friend Dan Moldea up on the board here. And Allie, let's see if we can do this. So you may have to call him back because I'm having some difficulty pulling him up. So let's see if we can get some closing comments from Dan Moldea about what happened tragically on this date in 1993. I think you're going to have to call Vince Foster back, Allie. So let's give it a shot and see what we can do here. There we go. We've got him. So Dan Moldea, let's see. We've got David in Atlanta. Is that David on? Okay, David. I'm having trouble with David. So let's while we wait for David, your thoughts about why this story took a life of its own, Dan Moldea. Why did this story, as they say, have legs?
Can I read just a brief section of this to you, Jim?
Sure.
Something that I write. I say, this is kind of my conclusion about this. I say, meantime, life in Washington continues. The big-time politicians, the partisan special interest groups, and the high-priced journalists, most of whom have masters of their own, continue to be judged by the quality of the people they seek and destroy. The bigger the target, the greater the reward. But in this particular case, Vincent Foster was never a major target. Still, when Foster ended the bitter note found in his briefcase with, here, ruining people is considered sport, he spoke a final truth before committing his desperate act. In doing so, however, he failed to recognize that in Washington, the sport is best played with tolerance as well as dignity and finesse. In this town, the real survivors are the bridge and chess players, not the brawlers who skate upon the thin ice which the game of politics has always been played. Perhaps for a moment after writing the note, Foster remembered this and took his own best counsel. He tore it up. But in the end, unable to balance the rules of the sport with his own problems, Vincent Foster drove to Fort Marcy Park on that hot summer day and took his own life. That's basically what I think happened to Vince Foster. I think that he found himself in this situation here in Washington. They call it a swamp, but it's been a fairly civilized swamp for many, many years. I mean, people get along, and it, when you look at Congress and everything, it's my colleague this, my friend on the other side of the aisle, and some of that still goes on. There is still a decorum that goes on in Congress, and I think there is still an attempt to find a degree of civility, which Foster never found because he was under attack as soon as he came into town. But again, the problems that he had professionally were overwhelmed by the problems that I think that he had personally. And right. There was nothing in his professional life that he couldn't maneuver out of.
David in Atlanta, we've got you. You're on the air with Dan Moldea. Hi, David.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thanks for having my favorite guest on, Jim. Two questions,
thank you,
if I may. around 2002, I had a tape that I lost in Katrina, New Orleans. Larry Nichols was a guest, and I'm sure we're all familiar with Mr. Nichols.
Yeah,
he was a guest
on
a conservative hate station in New Orleans, and he said, and this is a quote, he had a tape of Hillary screwing Vince Foster, and he would release it when Hillary ran for president. I think that's an example of the vicious lies from the right that was used to attack the Clintons. And Mr. Moldea, at the trial next week of Paul Manafort, and I think we could all agree he's likely to be convicted on several counts facing life imprisonment. What, if any, evidence do you think may be disclosed connecting the President of the United States to illegal activity by his one-time campaign manager?
All right. Dan, would you respond to David in Atlanta?
I'm looking at the Russian oligarchs. I'm looking at the Russian mafia. I still believe that this entire investigation is going to be a series of major RICO indictments that are coming, Racketeer Influence, Corrupt Organizations Act, the same law that's used to bring down mafia families. And I'm anticipating that this is going to be the opening salvo in what is going to be possibly one of the biggest investigations and series of indictments ever against people in government and those who've been connected to the Trump operation. I think we are in store for some really, really horrible times. I think that this man who is deserving of a great comeuppance is going to give us the motherload of all consequences as a result of it, because he's not going to go quietly. And again, I think that all of this is an attempt to flip Manafort to testify against Trump.
All right.
With regard to Russia and the Russian oligarchs and ultimately the Russian mafia.
We will follow it with you. Thank you, Dan Mulday. It is always good to talk with you.
Jim, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir. Thank you, David.
See you soon. Have a good day. Take care. And we're joined in studio by Molly Bookman of the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater. She's always busy, not just during the holiday season with the Nutcracker. She's busy. It's a 365-day proposition, isn't it?
Good morning, Jim.
Dancing your little heart away.
Yes, we are. And isn't it nice to talk about making something beautiful for the city?
Yeah, I think if more members of Congress were dancing, we'd have a better world, wouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely.
And they'd be in a lot better shape. Some of these guys are not in very good
they
shape.
They would be in much better shape and much happier and healthier.
You're right about that. Well, this summer dance intensive, tell us about this.
Well, it's a really exciting opportunity. We do it every year, but this year is special because not only are we bringing in three international artists, they are all natives of Baton Rouge with well-established, wonderful careers in the world of dance. They're all, as we speak, they are all in Europe. They will be here in 2 weeks. That's starting July the 30th. There's Shelby Williams, who is a soloist with the Royal Ballet of Flanders. There is Dwayne Holiday, who is left Baton Rouge to dance. Well, he danced with many places of Cincinnati and Milwaukee, but he left the States to dance with Ballet Am Rhein in Dusseldorf, and now he is a freelance artist. And then there's Taylor Mitchell, who is in Germany right now. He is much sought after, hard to schedule, especially because in Germany they want him everywhere to teach American-style jazz.
And this starts in 10 days, doesn't
it? Starts in 10 days, and it's open to anyone who would like to come over the age of 12, who would like to brush up, get some new techniques, some new ideas, work with some international artists, and just focus on dance for a week.
July the 30th through August the 3rd, and for those who'd like more information, the best way to contact you and
You can go to the Baton Rouge Ballet, the website, batonrougeballet.org. You can call the ballet office at 766-8379, and you can talk to these people's families because they're all native Baton Rougeans who got their start dancing with the Baton Rouge Ballet.
And one of these teachers has 85,000 followers on her Instagram account. Yeah. Is that correct? That's a lot of followers, isn't it?
She's quite well known in the dance world as the Biscuit Ballerina.
Who is this?
Shelby Williams.
The Biscuit Ballerina.
The Biscuit Ballerina.
Now, how do you get a name like that?
Well, she gave it to herself with her blog, on her blog called Biscuit Ballerina, mm-hmm. where she shows examples of dancers whose technique is not quite up to herself as a dancer without impeccable technique. And she did it originally for her dance friends, for them to look at things, but now it has become very popular in the dance world as a way for people, she says, to take themselves more lightly. We're so critical of ourselves in the dance world and of our bodies and of our technique. And this was a way for her to help people look at things more lightly. It's humorous.
As you know, and we've talked about it, dancers are like athletes, and they have injuries, particularly back problems. It seems to go with the territory, doesn't it? How do you overcome that over time?
Well, you have to be consistent with your training. You know, we hear about athletes. When we were young, athletes would have a season, and they would get in shape for that season. Mm-hmm. Now they try to stay in shape all year. But ballet dancers have always known that. You take class your entire life. If you're a dancer, you are taking class. If you're not taking class, you're not a dancer. That's how you stay in shape. That's what keeps you strong. If you don't do it, ballet is so rigorous that, yes, you're likely to get injured if all of a sudden you go in and try some of the repertory.
You don't see many fat ballet dancers, do you?
Well, no, you don't. Not only because it's probably not appealing for the audience, but also because the body takes care of that. If you are dancing every day, full out, the way dancers do, it's much more athletic than most people know. People who have experience, you know, dancing a little mm-hmm. with the local dance team mm-hmm. or dancing school don't really understand the amount of work that goes into the professional dancer's life.
Yeah, well, ballet is like the Super Bowl, but dancing of any kind is rigorous. And I talked to my friend Lane McDaniel the other night. He said he had 200 hours of lessons for his 3 or 4 minute performance in Dancing with the Stars.
Right. It takes a lot. It is. You don't just get up and do it. There's a lot of social dance and a lot of folk dance and that sort of thing that you can be naturally good at. But to any kind of performance, or competition. It takes a lot of work.
Summer Dance Intensive, July 30th through August 3rd. So that's 10 days from now, and it'll last about five days.
It's 5 days all day, four classes a day. You can come for the week, or you can come for a day. You just need to give us a call and sign up ahead of time.
All right, and the phone number is?
766-8379.
766-8379, 225-766-8379. Thank you, Molly Buckman, and congratulations for all you do for our community.
Thank you,
I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
I hope so.
Maybe around your birthday, November 22nd.
You're amazing.
And for Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill, hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back Monday, same time, same place. Renee Chatelain will be here speaking of dancers. And until then, we're glad you're listening. Stay tuned.